There seemed no hope of any real fighting. When we left Monte Posero, I had counted my cartridges and found that in nearly 3 weeks I had fired just 3 shots at the enemy. They say it takes 1,000 bullets to kill a man, and at this rate it would be 20 years before I killed my first fascist. At Monte Oscuro, the lines were closer and one fired oftener, but I'm reasonably certain that I never hit anyone. As a matter of fact, on this front, and at this period of the war, the real weapon was not the rifle, but the megaphone. Being unable to kill your enemy, you shouted at him instead. This method of warfare is so extraordinary that it needs explaining. Wherever the lines were within hailing distance of one another, there was always a good deal of shouting from trench to trench, from ourselves, fascistas maricones, from the fascists, viva España, viva Franco, or when they knew that there were English opposite them, go home, you English, we don't want foreigners here. On the government side, in the party militias, the shouting of propaganda to undermine the enemy morale had been developed into a regular technique. In every suitable position, men, usually machine gunners, were told off for shouting duty and provided with megaphones. Generally, they shouted a set piece full of revolutionary sentiments which explained to the fascist soldiers that they were merely the hirelings of international capitalism, that they were fighting against their own class, etc., etc., and urged them to come over to our side. This was repeated over and over by relays of men. Sometimes it continued almost the whole night. There is very little doubt that it had its effect. Everyone agreed that the trickle of fascist deserters was partly caused by it. If one comes to think of it, when some poor devil of a sentry, very likely a socialist or anarchist trade union member who has been conscripted against his will, is freezing at his post, the slogan, "Don't fight against your own class," ringing again and again through the darkness, is bound to make an impression on him. It might make just the difference between deserting and not deserting. Of course, such a proceeding doesn't fit in with the English conception of war. I admit I was amazed and scandalized when I first saw it done. The idea of trying to convert your enemy instead of shooting him. I now think that from any point of view it was a legitimate maneuver. In ordinary trench warfare, when there is no artillery, it is extremely difficult to inflict casualties on the enemy without receiving an equal number yourself. If you can immobilize a certain number of men by making them desert, so much the better. Deserters are actually more useful to you than corpses because they can give information. But at the beginning, it dismayed all of us. It made us feel that the Spaniards were not taking this war of theirs sufficiently seriously. The man who did the shouting at the PSUC post down on our right was an artist at the job. Sometimes, instead of shouting revolutionary slogans, he simply told the fascists how much better we were fed than they were. His account of the government rations was apt to be a little imaginative. "Buttered toast," you could hear his voice echoing across the lonely valley. "We're just sitting down to buttered toast over here. Lovely slices of buttered toast." I do not doubt that, like the rest of us, he had not seen butter for weeks or months past. But in the icy night, the news of buttered toast probably set many a fascist mouth watering. It even made mine water, though I knew he was lying. One day in February, we saw a fascist aeroplane approaching. As usual, a machine gun was dragged into the open and its barrel cocked up, and everyone lay on his back to get a good aim. Our isolated positions were not worth bombing, and as a rule, the few fascist aeroplanes that passed our way circled round to avoid machine gun fire. This time, the aeroplane came straight over, too high up to be worth shooting at, and out of it came tumbling not bombs, but white glittering things that turned over and over in the air. A few fluttered down into the position. They were copies of a fascist newspaper, the Heraldo de Aragon, announcing the fall of Malaga. That night the fascists made a sort of abortive attack. I was just getting down into kip, half dead with sleep, when there was a heavy stream of bullets overhead, and someone shouted into the dugout, "They're attacking." I grabbed my rifle and slithered up to my post, which was at the top of the position beside the machine gun. There was utter darkness and diabolical noise. The fire of, I think, 5 machine guns was pouring upon us, and there was a series of heavy crashes caused by the fascists flinging bombs over their own parapet in the most idiotic manner. It was intensely dark. Down in the valley to the left of us, I could see the greenish flash of rifles where a small party of fascists, probably a patrol, were chipping in. The bullets were flying round us in the darkness. Crack, zip, crack. A few shells came whistling over, but they fell nowhere near us, and as usual in this war, most of them failed to explode. I had a bad moment when yet another machine gun opened fire from the hilltop in our rear, actually a gun that had been brought up to support us, but at the time it looked as though we were surrounded. Presently our own machine gun jammed, as it always did jam with those vile cartridges, and the ramrod was lost in the impenetrable darkness. Apparently there was nothing that one could do except stand still and be shot at. The Spanish machine gunners disdained to take cover, in fact exposed themselves deliberately, so I had to do likewise. Petty though it was, the whole experience was very interesting. It was the first time that I had been properly speaking under fire, and to my humiliation I found that I was horribly frightened. You always, I notice, feel the same when you're under heavy fire, not so much afraid of being hit as afraid because you don't know where you'll be hit. You're wondering all the while just where the bullet will nip you, and it gives your whole body a most unpleasant sensitiveness. After an hour or two, the firing slowed down and died away. Meanwhile, we had had only one casualty. The fascists had advanced a couple of machine guns into no man's land, but they'd kept a safe distance and made no attempt to storm our parapet. They were, in fact, not attacking, merely wasting cartridges and making a cheerful noise to celebrate the fall of Malaga. The chief importance of the affair was that it taught me to read the war news in the papers with a more disbelieving eye. A day or two later, the newspapers and the radio published reports of a tremendous attack with cavalry and tanks up a perpendicular hillside which had been beaten off by the heroic English. When the fascists told us that Malaga had fallen, we set it down as a lie. But next day there were more convincing rumours, and it must have been a day or two later that it was admitted officially. By degrees, the whole disgraceful story leaked out, how the town had been evacuated without firing a shot, and how the fury of the Italians had fallen not upon the troops who were gone, but upon the wretched civilian population, some of whom were pursued and machine-gunned for 100 miles. The news sent a sort of chill all along the line, for, whatever the truth may have been, every man in the militia believed that the loss of Malaga was due to treachery. It was the first talk I had heard of treachery or divided aims. It set up in my mind the first vague doubt about this war in which, hitherto, the rights and wrongs had seemed so beautifully simple. In mid-February we left Monte Oscuro and were sent, together with all the Poom troops in the sector, to make a part of the army besieging Huesca. It was a 50-mile lorry journey across the wintry plain, where the clipped vines were not yet budding, and the blades of the winter barley were just poking through the lumpy soil. 4 kilometres from our new trenches, Huesca glittered small and clear, like a city of dolls' houses. Months earlier, when Ciatama was taken, the general commanding the government troops had said gaily, "Tomorrow we'll have coffee in Huesca." It turned out that he was mistaken. There had been bloody attacks, but the town did not fall, and "Tomorrow we'll have coffee in Huesca" had become a standing joke throughout the army. If I ever go back to Spain, I shall make a point of having a cup of coffee in Huesca. Chapter 5. On the eastern side of Huesca, until late March, nothing happened. Almost literally nothing. We were 1,200 metres from the enemy. When the fascists were driven back into Huesca, the Republican troops who held this part of the line had not been overzealous in their advance, so that the line formed a kind of pocket. Later it would have to be advanced, a ticklish job under fire. But for the present, the enemy might as well have been non-existent. Our sole preoccupation was keeping warm and getting enough to eat. As a matter of fact, there were things in this period that interested me greatly, and I will describe some of them later. But I shall be keeping nearer to the order of events if I try here to give some account of the internal political situation on the government side. At the beginning, I had ignored the political side of the war, and it was only about this time that it began to force itself upon my attention. If you're not interested in the horrors of party politics, please skip. I'm trying to keep the political parts of this narrative in separate chapters for precisely that purpose. But at the same time, it would be quite impossible to write about the Spanish War from a purely military angle. It was, above all things, a political war. No event in it, at any rate during the first year, is intelligible unless one has some grasp of the inter-party struggle that was going on behind the government lines. When I came to Spain, and for some time afterwards, I was not only uninterested in the political situation, but unaware of it. I knew there was a war on, but I had no notion what kind of a war. If you had asked me why I had joined the militia, I should have answered, to fight against fascism. And if you had asked me what I was fighting for, I should have answered, common decency. I had accepted the News Chronicle, New Statesman version of the war as the defence of civilization against a maniacal outbreak by an army of Colonel Blimps in the pay of Hitler. The revolutionary atmosphere of Barcelona had attracted me deeply, but I had made no attempt to understand it. As for the kaleidoscope of political parties and trade unions, with their tiresome names, PSUC, POUM, FAI, CNT, UGT, JCI, JSU, AIT, they merely exasperated me. It looked at first sight as though Spain were suffering from a plague of initials. I knew that I was serving in something called the POUM. I had only joined the POUM militia rather than any other, because I happened to arrive in Barcelona with ILP papers. But I didn't realise that there were serious differences between the political parties. At Monteposero, when they pointed to the position on our left and said, "Those are the socialists," meaning the PSUC, I was puzzled and said, "Aren't we all socialists?" I thought it idiotic that people fighting for their lives should have separate parties. My attitude always was, why can't we drop all this political nonsense and get on with the war? This, of course, was the correct anti-fascist attitude, which had been carefully disseminated by the English newspapers, largely in order to prevent people from grasping the real nature of the struggle. But in Spain, especially in Catalonia, it was an attitude that no one could or did keep up indefinitely. Everyone, however unwillingly, took sides sooner or later. For even if one cared nothing for the political parties and their conflicting lines, it was too obvious that one's own destiny was involved. As a militiaman, one was a soldier against Franco, but one was also a pawn in an enormous struggle that was being fought out between two political theories. When I scrounged for firewood on the mountainside and wondered whether this was really a war or whether the News Chronicle had made it up, when I dodged the communist machine guns and the Barcelona riots, when I finally fled from Spain with the police one jump behind me, all these things happened to me in that particular way because I was serving in the POUM militia and not in the PSUC. So great is the difference between two sets of initials. To understand the alignment on the government side, one has got to remember how the war started. When the fighting broke out on the 18th of July, it is probable that every anti-fascist in Europe felt a thrill of hope, for here at last, apparently, was democracy standing up to fascism. For years past, the so-called democratic countries had been surrendering to fascism at every step. The Japanese had been allowed to do as they liked in Manchuria. Hitler had walked into power and proceeded to massacre political opponents of all shades. Mussolini had bombed the Abyssinians while 53 nations, I think it was 53, made pious noises off. But when Franco tried to overthrow a mildly left-wing government, the Spanish people, against all expectation, had risen against him. It seemed, possibly it was, the turning of the tide. But there were several points that escaped general notice. To begin with, Franco was not strictly comparable with Hitler or Mussolini. His rising was a military mutiny backed up by the aristocracy and the church, and in the main, especially at the beginning, it was an attempt not so much to impose fascism as to restore feudalism, This meant that Franco had against him not only the working class, but also various sections of the liberal bourgeoisie, the very people who are the supporters of fascism when it appears in a more modern form. More important than this was the fact that the Spanish working class did not, as we might conceivably do in England, resist Franco in the name of democracy and the status quo. Their resistance was accompanied by, one might almost say it consisted of, a definite revolutionary outbreak. Land was seized by the peasants. Many factories and most of the transport were seized by the trade unions. Churches were wrecked and the priests driven out or killed. The Daily Mail, amid the cheers of the Catholic clergy, was able to represent Franco as a patriot delivering his country from hordes of fiendish Reds. For the first few months of the war, Franco's real opponent was not so much the government as the trade unions. As soon as the rising broke out, the organized town workers replied by calling a general strike and then by demanding, and after a struggle getting, arms from the public arsenals. If they had not acted spontaneously and more or less independently, it is quite conceivable that Franco would never have been resisted. There can, of course, be no certainty about this, but there is at least reason for thinking it. The government had made little or no attempt to forestall the rising, which had been foreseen for a long time past, and when the trouble started, its attitude was weak and hesitant. So much so, indeed, that Spain had three premiers in a single day, Quiroga, Barrios, and Guerrero. The first two refused to distribute arms to the trade unions. Moreover, the one step that could save the immediate situation, the arming of the workers, was only taken unwillingly and in response to violent popular clamour. However, the arms were distributed. And in the big towns of eastern Spain, the fascists were defeated by a huge effort, mainly of the working class, aided by some of the armed forces, assault guards, etc., who had remained loyal. It was the kind of effort that could probably only be made by people who were fighting with a revolutionary intent, i.e. believed that they were fighting for something better than the status quo. In the various centres of revolt, it is thought that 3,000 people died in the streets in a single day. Men and women, armed only with sticks of dynamite, rushed across the open squares and stormed stone buildings held by trained soldiers with machine guns. Machine gun nests that the fascists had placed at strategic spots were smashed by rushing taxis at them at 60 miles an hour. Even if one had heard nothing of the seizure of the land by the peasants, the setting up of local Soviets, etc., it would be hard to believe that the anarchists and socialists, who were the backbone of the resistance, were doing this kind of thing for the preservation of capitalist democracy, which, especially in the anarchist view, was no more than a centralized swindling machine. Meanwhile, the workers had weapons in their hands, and at this stage they refrained from giving them up. Even a year later, it was computed that the anarcho-syndicalists in Catalonia possessed 30,000 rifles. The estates of the big pro-fascist landlords were in many places seized by the peasants. Along with the collectivization of industry and transport, there was an attempt to set up the rough beginnings of a workers' government by means of local committees, workers' patrols to replace the old pro-capitalist police forces, workers' militias based on the trade unions, and so forth. Of course, the process was not uniform, and it went further in Catalonia than elsewhere. There were areas where the institutions of local government remained almost untouched, and others where they existed side by side with revolutionary committees. In a few places, independent anarchist communes were set up, and some of them remained in being till about a year later, when they were forcibly suppressed by the government. In Catalonia, for the first few months, most of the actual power was in the hands of the anarcho-syndicalists, who controlled most of the key industries. The thing that had happened in Spain was, in fact, not merely a civil war, but the beginning of a revolution. It is this fact that the anti-fascist press outside Spain has made its special business to obscure. The issue has been narrowed down to fascism versus democracy, and the revolutionary aspect concealed as much as possible. In England, where the press is more centralized and the public more easily deceived than elsewhere, only two versions of the Spanish War have had any publicity to speak of. The right-wing version of Christian patriots versus Bolsheviks dripping with blood, and the left-wing version of gentlemanly Republicans quelling a military revolt. The central issue has been successfully covered up. There were several reasons for this. To begin with, appalling lies about atrocities were being circulated by the pro-fascist press, and well-meaning propagandists undoubtedly thought that they were aiding the Spanish government by denying that Spain had gone red. But the main reason was this, that, except for the small revolutionary groups which exist in all countries, the whole world was determined upon preventing revolution in Spain. In particular, the Communist Party, with Soviet Russia behind it, had thrown its whole weight against the revolution. It was the communist thesis that revolution at this stage would be fatal, and that what was to be aimed at in Spain was not workers' control, but bourgeois democracy. It hardly needs pointing out why liberal capitalist opinion took the same line. Foreign capital was heavily invested in Spain. The Barcelona Traction Company, for instance, represented 10 millions of British capital. And meanwhile, the trade unions had seized all the transport in Catalonia. If the revolution went forward, there would be no compensation, or very little. If the capitalist republic prevailed, foreign investments would be safe. And since the revolution had got to be crushed, it greatly simplified things to pretend that no revolution had happened. In this way, the real significance of every event could be covered up. Every shift of power from the trade unions to the central government could be represented as a necessary step in military reorganization. The situation produced was curious in the extreme. Outside Spain, few people grasped that there was a revolution. Inside Spain, nobody doubted it. Even the PSUC newspapers, communist-controlled and more or less committed to an anti-revolutionary policy, talked about our glorious revolution. And meanwhile, the communist press in foreign countries were shouting that there was no sign of revolution anywhere. The seizure of factories, setting up of workers' committees, etc., had not happened, or alternatively had happened but had no political significance. According to the Daily Worker, on the 6th of August 1936, those who said that the Spanish people were fighting for social revolution or for anything other than bourgeois democracy were downright lying scoundrels. On the other hand, Juan López, a member of the Valencia government, declared in February 1937 that the Spanish people are shedding their blood not for the Democratic Republic and its paper constitution, but for a revolution. So it would appear that the downright lying scoundrels included members of the government for which we were bidden to fight. Some of the foreign anti-fascist papers even descended to the pitiful lie of pretending that churches were only attacked when they were used as fascist fortresses. Actually, churches were pillaged everywhere, and as a matter of course, because it was perfectly well understood that the Spanish church was part of the capitalist racket. In 6 months in Spain, I only saw two undamaged churches, and until about July 1937, no churches were allowed to reopen and hold services, except for one or two Protestant churches in Madrid. But after all, it was only the beginning of a revolution, not the complete thing. Even when the workers, certainly in Catalonia and possibly elsewhere, had the power to do so, they did not overthrow or completely replace the government. Obviously, they couldn't do so when Franco was hammering at the gate and sections of the middle class were on their side. The country was in a transitional state that was capable either of developing in the direction of socialism or of reverting to an ordinary capitalist republic. The peasants had most of the land, and they were likely to keep it unless Franco won. All large industries had been collectivized, but whether they remained collectivized or whether capitalism was reintroduced would depend finally upon which group gained control. At the beginning, both the central government and the Generalitat de Catalunya, the semi-autonomous Catalan government, could definitely be said to represent the working class. The government was headed by Caballero, a left-wing socialist, and contained ministers representing the UGT, socialist trade unions, and the CNT, syndicalist unions controlled by the anarchists. The Catalan Generalité was for a while virtually superseded by an anti-fascist defense committee consisting mainly of delegates from the trade unions. This was the Comité Central de Milicias Antifascistas. Delegates were chosen in proportion to the membership of their organizations. 9 delegates represented the trade unions, 3 the Catalan liberal parties, and 2 the various Marxist parties, PUM, communists, and others. Later, the defense committee was dissolved, and the Generalité was reconstituted so as to represent the unions and the various left-wing parties. But every subsequent reshuffling of the government was a move towards the right. First, the PUM was expelled from the Generalité. 6 months later, Caballero was replaced by the right-wing socialist Negrín. Shortly afterwards, the CNT was eliminated from the government. Then the UGT. Then the CNT was turned out of the Generalité. Finally, a year after the outbreak of war and revolution, there remained a government composed entirely of right-wing socialists, liberals, and communists. The general swing to the right dates from about October-November 1936, when the USSR began to supply arms to the government and power began to pass from the anarchists to the communists. Except Russia and Mexico, no country had the decency to come to the rescue of the government, and Mexico, for obvious reasons, could not supply arms in large quantities. Consequently, the Russians were in a position to dictate terms. There is very little doubt that these terms were, in substance, prevent revolution or you get no weapons, and that the first move against the revolutionary elements, the expulsion of the PUM from the Catalan Generalité, was done under orders from the USSR. It has been denied that any direct pressure was exerted by the Russian government, but the point is not of great importance, for the communist parties of all countries can be taken as carrying out Russian policy, and it is not denied that the Communist Party was the chief mover first against the PUM, later against the anarchists and against Caballero's section of the socialists, and in general against a revolutionary policy. Once the USSR had intervened, the triumph of the Communist Party was assured. To begin with, gratitude to Russia for the arms and the fact that the Communist Party, especially since the arrival of the international brigades, looked capable of winning the war, immensely raised the communist prestige. Secondly, the Russian arms were supplied via the Communist Party and the parties allied to them, who saw to it that as few as possible got to their political opponents. This was why there were so few Russian arms on the Aragon front, where the troops were predominantly anarchist. Until April 1937, the only Russian weapon I saw, with the exception of some aeroplanes, which may or may not have been Russian, was a solitary submachine gun. Thirdly, by proclaiming a non-revolutionary policy, the communists were able to gather in all those whom the extremists had scared. It was easy, for instance, to rally the wealthier peasants against the collectivization policy of the anarchists. There was an enormous growth in the membership of the party, and the influx was largely from the middle class, shopkeepers, officials, army officers, well-to-do peasants, etc., etc. The war was essentially a triangular struggle. The fight against Franco had to continue, but the simultaneous aim of the government was to recover such power as remained in the hands of the trade unions. It was done by a series of small moves, a policy of pinpricks, as somebody called it. And on the whole, very cleverly, there was no general and obvious counter-revolutionary move. And until May 1937, it was scarcely necessary to use force. The workers could always be brought to heel by an argument that is almost too obvious to need stating. Unless you do this, that, and the other, we shall lose the war. In every case, needless to say, it appeared that the thing demanded by military necessity was the surrender of something that the workers had won for themselves in 1936. But the argument could hardly fail, because to lose the war was the last thing that the revolutionary parties wanted. If the war was lost, democracy and revolution, socialism and anarchism became meaningless words. The anarchists, the only revolutionary party that was big enough to matter, were obliged to give way on point after point. The process of collectivization was checked, The local committees were got rid of, the workers' patrols were abolished, and the pre-war police forces, largely reinforced and very heavily armed, were restored. And various key industries, which had been under the control of the trade unions, were taken over by the government. The seizure of the Barcelona telephone exchange, which led to the May fighting, was one incident in this process. Finally, most important of all, the workers' militias, based on the trade unions, were gradually broken up and redistributed among the new popular army, a non-political army on semi-bourgeois lines with a differential pay rate, a privileged officer caste, etc., etc. In the special circumstances, this was the really decisive step. It happened later in Catalonia than anywhere else, because it was there that the revolutionary parties were strongest. Obviously, the only guarantee that the workers could have of retaining their winnings was to keep some of the armed forces under their own control. As usual, the breaking up of the militias was done in the name of military efficiency. And no one denied that a thorough military reorganization was needed. It would, however, have been quite possible to reorganize the militias and make them more efficient while keeping them under direct control of the trade unions. The main purpose of the change was to make sure that the anarchists did not possess an army of their own. Moreover, the democratic spirit of the militias made them breeding grounds for revolutionary ideas. The communists were well aware of this and inveighed ceaselessly and bitterly against the PUM and anarchist principle of equal pay for all ranks. A general bourgeoisification, a deliberate destruction of the equalitarian spirit of the first few months of the revolution, was taking place. All happened so swiftly that people making successive visits to Spain at intervals of a few months have declared that they seemed scarcely to be visiting the same country. What had seemed on the surface and for a brief instant to be a workers' state was changing before one's eyes into an ordinary bourgeois republic with the normal division into rich and poor. By the autumn of 1937, the socialist Negrín was declaring in public that we respect private property, and members of the Cortes, who at the beginning of the war had had to fly the country because of their suspected fascist sympathies, were returning to Spain. The whole process is easy to understand if one remembers that it proceeds from the temporary alliance that fascism, in certain forms, forces upon the bourgeois and the worker. This alliance, known as the Popular Front, is, in essential, an alliance of enemies, and it seems probable that it must always end by one partner swallowing the other. The only unexpected feature in the Spanish situation, and outside Spain it has caused an immense amount of misunderstanding, is that among the parties on the government side, the communists stood not upon the extreme left, but upon the extreme right. In reality, this should cause no surprise, because the tactics of the Communist Party elsewhere, especially in France, have made it clear that official communism must be regarded, at any rate for the time being, as an anti-revolutionary force. The whole of Comintern policy is now subordinated, excusably considering the world situation, to the defense of the USSR, which depends upon a system of military alliances. In particular, the USSR is in alliance with France, a capitalist imperialist country. The alliance is of little use to Russia unless French capitalism is strong. Therefore, communist policy in France has got to be anti-revolutionary. This means not only that French communists now march behind the tricolour and sing the Marseillaise, but, what is more important, that they have had to drop all effective agitation in the French colonies. It is less than 3 years since Torres, the secretary of the French Communist Party, was declaring that the French workers would never be bamboozled into fighting against their German comrades. He is now one of the loudest-lunged patriots in France. The clue to the behaviour of the Communist Party in any country is the military relation of that country, actual or potential, towards the USSR. In England, for instance, the position is still uncertain. Hence, the English Communist Party is still hostile to the national government. and ostensibly opposed to rearmament. If, however, Great Britain enters into an alliance or military understanding with the USSR, the English communist, like the French communist, will have no choice but to become a good patriot and imperialist. There are premonitory signs of this already. In Spain, the communist line was undoubtedly influenced by the fact that France, Russia's ally, would strongly object to a revolutionary neighbour and would raise heaven and earth to prevent the liberation of Spanish Morocco. The Daily Mail, with its tales of Red Revolution financed by Moscow, was even more wildly wrong than usual. In reality, it was the communists above all others who prevented revolution in Spain. Later, when the right-wing forces were in full control, the communists showed themselves willing to go a great deal further than the liberals in hunting down the revolutionary leaders. I've tried to sketch the general course of the Spanish Revolution during its first year, because this makes it easier to understand the situation at any given moment. But I do not want to suggest that in February I held all of the opinions that are implied in what I've said above. To begin with, the things that most enlighten me had not yet happened. And in any case, my sympathies were in some ways different from what they are now. This was partly because the political side of the war bored me, and I naturally reacted against the viewpoint of which I'd heard most, i.e. the POUM-ILP viewpoint. The Englishmen I was among were mostly ILP members, with a few CP members among them, and most of them were much better educated politically than myself. For weeks on end, during the dull period when nothing was happening round Huesca, I found myself in the middle of a political discussion that practically never ended. In the draughty, evil-smelling barn of the farmhouse where we were billeted, in the stuffy blackness of dugouts, behind the parapet in the freezing midnight hours, the conflicting party lines were debated over and over. Among the Spaniards it was the same, and most of the newspapers we saw made the inter-party feud their chief feature. One would have had to be deaf or an imbecile not to pick up some idea of what the various parties stood for. From the point of view of political theory, there were only three parties that mattered: the PSUC, the PUM, and the CNTFAI, loosely described as the anarchists. I take the PSUC first as being the most important. It was the party that finally triumphed, and even at this time it was visibly in the ascendant. It is necessary to explain that when one speaks of the PSUC line, one really means the Communist Party line. The PSUC, Partido Socialista Unificado de Catalunya, was the Socialist Party of Catalonia. It had been formed at the beginning of the war by the fusion of various Marxist parties, including the Catalan Communist Party, but it was now entirely under communist control and was affiliated to the Third International. Elsewhere in Spain, no formal unification between socialists and communists had taken place, but the communist viewpoint and the right-wing socialist viewpoint could everywhere be regarded as identical. Roughly speaking, the PSUC was the political organization of the UGT, Unión General de Trabajadores, the Socialist Trade Unions. The membership of these unions throughout Spain now numbered about 1.5 million. They contained many sections of the manual workers, but since the outbreak of war, they had also been swollen by a large influx of middle-class members. For in the early revolutionary days, people of all kinds had found it useful to join either the UGT or the CNT. The two blocks of unions overlapped, but of the two, the CNT was more definitely a working-class organization. The PSUC was, therefore, a party partly of the workers and partly of the small bourgeoisie, the shopkeepers, the officials, and the wealthier peasants. The PSUC line, which was preached in the communist and pro-communist press throughout the world, was approximately this. At present, nothing matters except winning the war. Without victory in the war, all else is meaningless. Therefore, this is not the moment to talk of pressing forward with the revolution. We can't afford to alienate the peasants by forcing collectivization upon them, and we can't afford to frighten away the middle classes who were fighting on our side. Above all, for the sake of efficiency, we must do away with revolutionary chaos. We must have a strong central government in place of local committees, and we must have a properly trained and fully militarized army under a unified command. Clinging on to fragments of workers' control and parroting revolutionary phrases is worse than useless. It is not merely obstructive, but even counter-revolutionary, because it leads to divisions which can be used against us by the fascists. At this stage, we are not fighting for the dictatorship of the proletariat. We are fighting for parliamentary democracy. Whoever tries to turn the civil war into a social revolution is playing into the hands of the fascists and is, in effect, if not intention, a traitor. The Poom line differed from this on every point, except, of course, the importance of winning the war. The Poom was one of those dissident communist parties which have appeared in many countries in the last few years as a result of the opposition to Stalinism, i.e. to the change, real or apparent, in communist policy. It was made up partly of ex-communists and partly of an earlier party, the Workers and Peasants Bloc. Numerically, it was a small party with not much influence outside Catalonia, and chiefly important because it contained an unusually high proportion of politically conscious members. The figures for the Poom membership are given as July 1936, 10,000, December 1936, 70,000, June 1937, 40,000, but these are from Poom sources. A hostile estimate would probably divide them by four. The only thing one can say with any certainty about the membership of the Spanish political parties is that every party overestimates its own numbers. In Catalonia, its chief stronghold was Lérida. It did not represent any bloc of trade unions. The Poom militiamen were mostly CNT members, but the actual party members generally belonged to the UGT. It was, however, only in the CNT that the Poom had any influence. The Poom line was approximately this. It is nonsense to talk of opposing fascism by bourgeois democracy. Bourgeois democracy is only another name for capitalism, and so is fascism. To fight against fascism on behalf of democracy is to fight against one form of capitalism on behalf of a second, which is liable to turn into the first at any moment. The only real alternative to fascism is workers' control. If you set up any less goal than this, you will either hand the victory to Franco or at best let in fascism by the back door. Meanwhile, the workers must cling to every scrap of what they have won. If they yield anything to the semi-bourgeois government, they can depend upon being cheated. The workers' militias and police forces must be preserved in their present form, and every effort to bourgeoisify them must be resisted. If the workers do not control the armed forces will control the workers. The war and the revolution are inseparable.